Section 8 of Astounding Stories 14, February 1931, by Various. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Tentacles from Below, by Anthony Gilmore. Chapter 6. The Monster with the Armlets of Gold. Hemingway Bowman's ardent wish, after he was whipped quickly through the round exit port of the Octopi submarine, was for a quick, clean death. The horror and mystery of his situation had left him with one conscious emotion, that he was afraid. The worst had been when he was hauled through the port, when, expecting anything, he had been able to see nothing in the dark, water-filled mystery ship. Deliberate tentacles had stroked over every inch of his body, tentacles that were not metal-scaled, as had been the arms of the creature that captured him. It was then that he guessed the true purpose of the metal suits the octopi wore: to protect their bodies against the lesser pressure near the surface of the sea. Inside the submarine they did not need them. He decided that the ship was used for rapidly transporting large numbers of the octopi to distant regions, and also for a weapon of offense and defense. The intelligence of the cuttlefish astounded him. Keith had got away. At least he knew that, and he thanked God for it. His bold stroke had not been in vain, his sacrifice not useless. After the inspection of the tentacles, Hemmy had been shoved into a corner of the octopi submarine. He had felt cords wrapped around his body. After being thus secured, he was left to himself. He was utterly alone, except for strange, vague shadows that floated through the darkness, shadows that heated his brain as he realized how many of the devilfish there were. Hours that seemed like endless days passed. Bowman concluded that the submarine had gone straight through the cavern and emerged finally into what seemed to be another sea. Dead silence filled the ship. What was happening, he could only guess. The craft seemed to run on forever. Never once did tentacles brush or inspect him again. Finally, the ship stopped, and a great round door opened in one wall. By the soft bluish glow that seeped in, Hemmy caught a glimpse of his surroundings, and his gorge rose at the sight. The ship was literally filled with a slowly waving forest of long black tentacles. Weird instruments, unlike anything he had ever seen, were grouped around the walls, and before them attendant octopi poised, their hideous eyes fixed and steady. There were no dividing decks as in the NX-1. The craft was one huge shell. Then came furious activity. The door fell shut again, and the ship shot off at a great speed. Hemmy felt sure they were advancing again to attack the NX-1, and at once began to try to reach his comrades through radiophone. He knew that Wells would come back. Finally he caught a human voice, and heard the NX-1's radio operator shout to the commander that he, Bowman, was alive and calling. But when he tried to speak further, the American craft's radio was silent. And then, in the octopi submarine, had come a soft glow of violet. Was it a more deadly weapon than the paralyzing ray? In great suspense the prisoner waited. Silence. Silence. Horrible doubts beset his mind. Was Keith refraining from firing his torpedoes because he, Bowman, was on board the enemy boat? The thought stung him. He tried desperately again to reach Wells, but there was no answer. Were the Americans dead? Age-long minutes passed. Then the exit port opened and several metal-clad octopi swam out. Hemmy had a glimpse of the NX-1 lying silent and apparently lifeless on the sea floor, a gaping hole in her bow. As if to taunt him with the sight, the creatures left the round door open, and presently Bowman beheld the octopi open the NX-1's starboard exit port and enter. Later, the port swung open again, and he saw the monsters emerge, each gripping several men clad in yellow sea suits. That they were dead or victims of the ray was obvious from the way they limply dangled. The exit port closed, and darkness filled the octopi ship. Hemmy Bowman panted with the futile effort to break his bonds. "You devils!" he yelled in blind rage, exhausted. "Why don't you take me with them? Take me! Take me, damn your stinking hides!" When Keith Wells was taken from the silent NX-1, a host of astounding impressions swarmed his brain. Swinging lightly at the end of his captor's tentacle, he strove as best he could, with eyes rigidly fixed straight ahead, to grasp his new surroundings. He had, first, one flash of the octopi ship lying quite close to them, its hulk, as always, immobile and apparently lifeless. And inside it, he was sure, was his friend and first officer, Hemmy Bowman, a captive. He saw that the octopi submarine had towed the NX-1 into one of the weird mound cities. His own ship was lying in what seemed a kind of public square, and crowds of black octopi were swarming around it as he and his crew were brought out. Shooting straight off the square ran one of the wide streets he had previously seen from above, and on each side the brown mound buildings rose. Their details were hazy, because of the cuttlefish inhabitants who swam thickly in front of them. His captors started their march down this broad street. Great crowds of reddish-colored octopi clustered on each side of it. Other swarms hung almost motionless, except for their constantly writhing tentacles. Above, so that their line of progress was through what resembled a restless, living tunnel of repulsive black flesh, snaky arms, and huge unblinking eyes. Keith felt faint from the horror of it. Thousands of the monsters were there, all hanging in the soft, blue-glowing water, and occasionally, as he floated almost horizontally in his captor's firm grip, his legs would brush the wall of clammy flesh, or perhaps one of the tentacles would reach out as if to touch him. The octopus that held him swam some 5 feet off the street bed itself. At intervals, the thick swarm on either side would part for a second, and Keith could glimpse the huge mound buildings, ever growing larger, with round entrance holes dotted all over their smooth surface, above as well as the sides. The march was ghastly. Their captors were taking them through the heart of the water metropolis, displaying their human captives as did the Caesars in Roman triumphs of old. The swarming crowds of tentacled monsters grew thicker as they progressed, and their tentacles began to whip more quickly, as if anger was burning in their loathsome bodies. Keith noted the menace of their sharp-beaked jaws, and the sickening sucker discs on the livid underside of the tentacles. As far as he could see, the swarms fell in behind the procession after it had passed, following them. Where? Just as Wells felt himself on the verge of fainting, the procession turned to the right and entered the largest mound building of all, a vast dome rising in the very center of the octopi metropolis. They continued through a corridor perhaps 20 feet high, from which at intervals other corridors branched. Held by one arm, and ever and again, turning helplessly over in his horizontal transit, Keith caught glimpses of walls covered with intricate designs on a basic eight-armed motif. Designs of artistic value that gave evidence of culture and civilization. The passage ended as suddenly as it had begun, and they came into the main body of a gigantic building. The commander could hardly credit his eyes. The place resembled a stadium, and was so vast that he felt dwarfed to nothingness. The domed roof soared far above in misty bluish light. On the floor, exactly beneath the center of the great dome, was a raised platform, and on it a dais resembling a very wide throne. Around the dais a score or more of octopi, officials Keith supposed, were grouped. Rapidly the creatures following the procession swam into the chamber. Monstrously large as the place was, the floor soon was filled with the thick flood of cuttlefish, which swarmed in from many doors. Keith, held with the other captives just to one side of the hole he had entered by, began to think that they must soon refuse to let any more in, when, to his surprise, he saw the latest arrivals begin to form a gallery 20 feet above those on the ground floor, and when this was extended far back and completely filled, start yet another above it, and another, and another. In 10 minutes the mighty hall was crowded with countless layers of the cold-eyed monsters, each layer angling up from the central dais so that all could see. God, the commander thought, nothing but solidly packed devilfish all the way to the dome. A slaughter pit. And we, of course, are to be the cattle. Minutes passed. The throne was still empty, and the thousands in the amphitheater seemed waiting for an occupant. Keith wished he was able to close his eyes. The restless, never-ceasing weaving of the countless tentacles in the levels above made the scene a nightmare. Some waved slowly, others whipped excitedly, but never for an instant did one pause. The movements were like the never-ceasing shifting and swaying of the trunks and feet of elephants. In the dim glow, the huge chamber seemed to be filled with one fantastic, million-tentacled monster that stared with its thousand eyes down on the forlorn group of puny human beings. As if at a command, the arms of the octopi on the platform suddenly began to weave in perfect unison in some weird ceremony. First they swayed out towards the waiting captives, then they swerved slowly to the empty throne, then came back a few quick, excited whippings, and once more the long arms reached out at the small group at the entrance. This went on for some minutes. Then, very suddenly, a creature swam up from what must have been an opening in the floor onto the dais throne. Keith saw it well. It was an octopus, a giant amongst octopi, and Wells knew at once it was the ruler of the realm, the lord and master of the swarming galleries and the cities of mound buildings. It was larger than its fellows by a full 3 feet, and, encircling each great tentacle just where it joined the central mass of flesh, was a broad, glittering band of polished gold, 8 thick armlets that ringed the creature's revolting head-body with a circle of gleaming pagan splendor. Keith could almost fancy that a certain royal air hung over the monster. The huge, unblinking eyes of the king stared at the horror-frozen captives. One long tentacle lifted slowly upward, and their captors at once started towards the throne with them. The score of octopi on each side stilled their weaving arms. A battery of emotionless eyes drilled into Wells's paralyzed body. He felt faint. Unquestionably, the horrible ceremony was leading up to some form of cold-blooded sacrifice. The monarch stretched a mighty arm towards Keith, and as in a dream he felt himself lifted out of his guard's grasp. The snake-like tentacle gripped him about the waist and held him dangling like a puppet 20 feet in the water, while the 2 deadly eyes stared steadily at him. He was brought closer, until the hideous central mass, with its cruel beaked jaw and ink sac hanging behind, was no more than 1 foot away. Then another arm stroked slowly along the commander's helpless body. Once or twice it prodded sharply, and Wells felt a surge of fear, for his sea suit might break. Deliberately the prying tentacle moved over him, delicately feeling his helmet, his weighted feet, his legs. Keith Wells grew angry. He was being inspected like a trapped monkey. He, commander of the NX-1, representative of one of the world's mightiest nations, prodded and stared at by this fish, this octopus. A great rage suffused him, and with a terrific effort he tried to jab his arms into one of those devilish eyes, but try as he might, his body would not respond. He could not move a finger. For a long time the loathsome inspection continued, until the monstrous king seemed satisfied. Wells was handed back. There followed an interminable period in which nothing whatever was done, as far as he could see. He was sure that they must be talking, debating, but no sound reached his ears through the tight helmet. All the time the endless motion in the swarming levels above went on. It became hazy, dreamlike, and in spite of himself the commander began to feel drowsy. The weaving and swaying was producing a hypnotic effect. At last the desire to sleep grew overpowering. Wells and his men were more than half unconscious when their original captors finally pulled them back from the royal presence and began a humble retreat from the throne room. Slowly they backed to the entrance. Keith's last drowsy glimpse was of a grotesque, gold-ringed monster on a throne, with a score of smaller tentacled creatures around him, and a vast haze of weaving tentacles and unblinking eyes above. They passed from the huge chamber. The commander felt delirious as in a nightmare, but he knew that they were again in the long corridor, and that their captors were taking them further into the mighty building, further from the street outside. He glimpsed great rooms branching off the corridor, and swarms of black octopi inside them. The light became fainter, and at last the procession turned into a separate, rough-walled chamber, dimly lit and empty. Wells felt the grip around his arm loosen, and he floated limply to the floor among his men. He slept. End of chapter 6. Section 9 of Astounding Stories 14, February 1931, by Various. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 7 The Glass Bell Jar. Keith awoke hours later. Slowly he became conscious of a cramped, stiff body, of a dull pain racking his head. He stretched out his limbs, and suddenly realized he could move. Remembering the paralyzing ray that had struck him down, and half afraid that his senses were tricking him, he kicked his left leg out. It moved with its old vigor. He quickly found that his strength had returned, that he could feel and move. The effect of the ray had worn off. With a glow of new hope, he rose to his feet and exercised numb muscles. Looking around, he saw the other men still stretched out on the floor of their rough-walled, watery prison. He called into his radiophone mouthpiece. "Graham! Graham, wake up!" A grotesque figure stirred among its fellows, turned over. "It's Wells, Graham," Keith continued. "Get up. You can now." And he watched the form of his big first officer stretch out and finally rise, while stupid, sleepy sounds came to his radio receiver. Why, the paralysis is gone," Graham said at length. "Yes, but maybe the octopi don't know it. Rouse the other men at once, and we'll see what we can do." It was weird, the sight of the lifeless figures of the men stirring to life in the dim-lit water as Graham shook each one's shoulder. The radiophones buzzed and clicked with their excited comments and ejaculations. Keith felt much better. With his men restored to strength and clustered in a determined, hard-fighting mass, he saw a hope of breaking out and regaining the NX-1. He let them exercise as he had for some minutes, then proceeded to a brisk roll call. There should be 15 men and 2 officers. Rapidly, Graham ran over the names, and each time a voice rang back in reply, until he came to the cook. "McKegnie? Cook McKegnie?" There was no answer. Wells stared around the group of dim figures and himself called the name again, but McKegnie was not present. And as the commander and his men realized it, the numbing spell of their desperate position settled down on them again like a shroud. Keith shook off the mood. "Well," he muttered, "I guess the devil's got him. Poor McKegnie's seen the wheels go round for the last time. All right. Take command, Graham. I'm going to do a little reconnoitering." The round entrance hole was some 15 feet from him, at the far end of the cell. Keith advanced cautiously to it, the peculiar light feeling the water gave him making his steps uncertain. The dim blue illumination made the details of the corridor outside hazy, shadowy, but it seemed to be empty. Peering out, Wells could sight no guarding octopi. He edged closer and stared down to the left. 20 feet away, the vague light tapered into darker gloom, filled with thick, wavering shadows, but it was apparently devoid of tentacles. He wondered if the octopi were unaware that the effects of their ray had worn off, and peeped cautiously around the edge to the right. Immediately a long arm whipped out, grasped him around the waist, and flung him twisting and turning back into the chamber. Graham laboriously made his way to the commander and helped him to his feet. "Hurt, sir?" he asked anxiously. "No," Keith gasped. "But that devil—" He stopped short. The first officer turned and followed his commander's stare. The entrance hole of the cell had filled with a monstrous shape. A huge octopus was resting there, its unblinking eyes coldly surveying the crew of the NX-1. On each of its thick tentacles was a broad band of polished gold. It was the king, the same creature that had inspected them from their throne dais a few hours before, and behind him in the corridor the men glimpsed another octopus. Slowly the ruler of the octopi swam into the chamber, its great eyes centered icily on Keith Wells, standing at the head of his cowering men, and its mighty tentacles waved slowly, gracefully, as if the creature stood in doubt. One of them tentatively reached out and hovered over their heads, moving uncertainly back and forth. Then, like a monstrous water snake, the tentacle poised, flicked out, and plucked a man from his comrades. His shriek of terror rasped in their earphones. "Steady, men," Keith cried. "It's hopeless to try and fight them. The monster just wants to look him over." The man, Williams, a petty officer, was dangled by the armpit in mid-water and made to slowly revolve. The tip of another huge arm snaked out and for some seconds stroked his body, probing curiously. He panted with fright, and in their earphones his friends could hear his every tortured exhalation. Anxiously, Keith watched. Then, without warning, another tentacle darted up, fastened its tip on the breast of the captive's sea suit, and deliberately ripped it open. The doomed man's last scream rang in their helmets as the water poured into his suit. They saw him writhe and struggle desperately in the remorseless grip which held him. The two huge eyes of the cuttlefish surveyed his death throes minutely, watched his agonized struggles gradually weaken, watched his legs and arms relax, his head sink lower, and then the tentacle let a lifeless body float to the floor. Jennerby, a huge engineer, went completely mad. "I'll get him, the devil!" he yelled, and before Keith could command him to stay back, had flung himself onto the giant king. Death came as a mere matter of course. Without apparent effort, the monarch ripped off Jennerby's helmet and sent him spinning back. The man's body writhed and shuddered, and in a moment another stark white face showed where death had struck. Trembling, sick at heart, the commander yet had to think of his men. "For God's sake," he cautioned them, "keep back. Don't try to fight now. We've got to wait our chance. Steady, steady." The king's deliberate tentacle again began its slow waving. It was choosing another victim, and this time it darted straight out at Keith Wells and gripped him with a mighty clutch about the waist. The commander did not cry out. As he was brought close to the staring eyes and felt their sinister gaze run over him, it flashed through him for some obscure reason that the monster knew him for what he was, the leader, from the tiny bars on each shoulder of his sea suit. He waited for the tentacles to rip it open, but they did not. Instead, the creature turned and swiftly swam with him out through the entrance hole. They went to the left in the corridor, further into the heart of the building. The bluish light became stronger. As Keith twisted in the giant monarch's grip, he glimpsed the other octopus following with the two dead men. He saved his strength, knowing it was hopeless just then to try and struggle free. Quick as was his passage, he noticed that the walls of the corridor were covered with intricate designs in bas-relief and colored. He passed row after row of mural paintings of octopi in various activities, and guessed that they represented the race's history. One was obviously a scene of battle, with a tentacled army locked in combat with another strange horde of fish-like creatures. A second showed the construction of the queer mound buildings on the seafloor, with scores of monsters hauling great chunks of material into place, and another pictured the huge audience chamber with a gold-banded king motionless on his throne. As the king drew him rapidly along, he had a glimpse through a circular doorway of a large room, inside which were clustered the black shapes of thousands of baby octopi, tended by what were evidently nurses. Other such rooms were passed, and the young commander's brain whirled as he tried to measure the size and progress of this undersea civilization. Perhaps the race of octopi was growing, reaching out, needed new room to colonize. That would explain why their submarine had been sent through the tunnel. A voice sounded in his ears. "Keith, are you all right?" It was Graham, calling from the cell behind. "So far," Wells assured him, "I'll keep in touch and let you know what happens." At that moment his captor carried him into a large chamber at the end of the corridor. He looked around and decided it was a laboratory. He beheld strange instruments, anatomical charts of octopi on the walls, and in one corner a small jar of glass in which a dull flame was burning. Many-shaped, keen-bladed knives lay on various low tables, and thin, wicked-looking prongs and pincers. "I'm in their experimental laboratory, Graham," Wells spoke into the mouthpiece of his tiny radio. And then his roving eyes saw something that made him audibly gasp. "What's the matter, Keith?" came the first officer's anxious voice. After a moment the commander answered, It's a pile of human bodies. The bodies of those fishermen. They've been experimenting on them." Was he, too, Wells wondered, to be experimented on? The sight of that stacked pile of bodies chilled him with horror. He kept his eyes from them till the octopus with the golden bands swung him through a hinged door in the farther wall. He found himself in a side room, smaller than the outer chamber, the whole center of which was occupied by a huge glass bell jar, some 30 feet in diameter. Inside it was much strange-looking apparatus on tables, and trays of operating instruments, knives like those in the outer room, and the same thin prongs. The great jar was empty of water, and on one side was an entrance port. The king tossed Keith into a corner and quickly donned a metal-scaled water suit. When he had it all on, and the glass body container fastened into place, he picked up his captive again and advanced through the bell jar's entrance port into a small water chamber. A moment later Wells felt his body grow heavy as the water of the compartment ran out, and then there was a click and he found himself inside the jar, still held in the merciless grip of a tentacle. He twisted around to find the cold eyes of the octopus staring at him only a foot away, and as he wondered what was going to happen next, the king unfastened the glass face shield of the commander's sea suit with a quick flip of the tip of a tentacle. Keith's arms were pinned to his sides. He could not move to try to refasten the face shield. Fearful, he held his breath. Held it until his face was purple and his lungs were near to bursting. But at last the limit was reached, and with a great wrench he sucked in a full breath. It was clean, fresh air. The air was like a breath of his own world brought down to this cold realm of octopi. Once he had caught up with his breathing, it poured new life into his limbs, jaded from the artificial air of the sea suit. Keith felt his muscles respond, felt his whole body glow with the new strength and life. 12 inches away, the king was watching his every reaction closely through the huge helmet of glass. The thought passed through the commander's mind that he was not only king, but chief scientist of this strange water civilization. Then, while his lungs swallowed hungrily the good fresh air, several tentacles began to feel around him in an attempt to unfasten the rest of his sea suit. Wells blanched at the sudden realization of how helpless he would be if the suit were taken from him. He would then not only be a prisoner of the octopi, but a prisoner of the glass jar, unable ever to leave it, and more than ever at the mercy of his captor's least whim. Not that he had any delusion that he would live long in any case. It was just the simple, strong instinct of self-preservation that made him grab at every chance for life. This thought flashed through his mind, even while the octopus was fumbling with the catches of his suit, and along with it was born a desperate plan of escape. He was in his own element, air, the octopus out of his. If he could crack the glass of the king's helmet and let the water out and air in, the glass was only 12 inches away. The commander stopped his resistance and at the same time felt about with his legs until he had them well braced against a lower tentacle. He pushed gently and came a few inches nearer the glass, a little more. Then with a quick, strong jerk of his body, he crashed the steel frame of his helmet square against the cuttlefish's sheathing of glass. The creature was taken wholly by surprise. Tentacles whipped out to tear the rash human quickly away, but not before Keith had pounded again and heard the splinter of smashed glass. He had jabbed a hole in the glass body piece, and already the life-giving water was pouring out. Panic seized the king, and he became a nightmare of tortured tentacles. Wells was flung wildly away and fetched up against the side of the jar with a crash that for a second stunned him. More and more water poured from the octopus's suit, and air at once rushed in to take its place. The creature's great eyes became filmy, while the revolting spidery body slewed here and there across the jar, all the time whipping and thrashing at the strangling air. Keith scurried from side to side, trying to keep out of reach of the crazy, writhing tentacles. Once a glancing blow knocked him flat, but the monster was altogether unconscious of him, and he got away. Little by little, the terrific whipping and coiling of the tentacles quieted down. The drowning king lay in one place now, its loathsome red body, no longer protected by glass, turned bluish. Keith thrilled with elation at his victory. And then, for the first time, he noticed that there was a full 3 inches of water on the floor, far too much to spill from the king's suit. A quick look around showed him where it came from. There was a long crack in the side of the glass jar, at the place where he had been crashed against it, and water was pouring in. Keith flung himself against the crack, jammed his arm into the broadest part of the leak, but still the water rushed in. The octopus was in its death throes, weakening steadily, but just as steadily the water poured in and rose up the sides of its body. In a flash, Wells saw that the liquid would win the race to cover it and allow the monster to resume breathing. "Oh, damn it!" he cursed fervently. "Now I've got to run for it." He stumbled to the port, snapping shut his face shield as he went. In a moment he had solved the working of the mechanism and was in the water chamber, then outside in the room itself. Fortunately, his sea suit was unhurt. He thanked heaven for that as he tore away a board-like piece of apparatus and jammed it over the leak in the jar. Keith paused a moment to plan. The king of the octopi was still writhing in ever-weakening struggles, but the water was halfway up his body. "It'll cover him soon," thought the commander, "and then it's a question how long it'll take him to come to. I've got to move fast, slip out into the corridor and run the gauntlet back to the men." His eyes rested on a large knife, and he appropriated it, since he saw nothing else he might use. For the first time since the beginning of the fight he answered the questions and exclamations that had constantly sounded in his ears from the distant crew. Tersely he told them what had happened, and of the gauntlet he had to run. "Make ready for a dash to the NX-1," he finished. "It's now or never. Wait 3 minutes for me, and if I don't make it, go ahead anyway. Remember, 3 minutes. This is an order. So long, fellows." He shut his ears to the bedlam of comment that followed. His knife ready, he took a few steps to the door and pushed out, right into the tentacles of a waiting octopus. His knife was useless. While locked motionless by three arms of his captor, another streaked out and wrenched it from his hand. Once again Keith was absolutely helpless. Great confusion resulted in the laboratory. The commander heard no sound, but the guard must have called, for five more octopi darted rapidly out of an adjoining room. Their tentacles writhing in great excitement, they swam past and into the inner chamber to the rescue of their nearly drowned king. The devilfish that held Wells almost crushed him to death in its excitement. It was obviously undecided what to do, but finally it sped him down the passageway and cast him back inside the cell with his men. Then it quickly retreated. The commander staggered to his feet and faced Graham and the others. "A miracle," he gasped. "I'll tell you later, but now we've got to make our break. The king's out, and we've got to get away before they bring him to. There's nothing to do but rush the door. It means sure death for half of us, and probably for all, but God help us if the king catches us." He paused and surveyed them keenly. "Everybody with me?" he asked, and not one man held back his answer. Wells smiled a little. "Good," he said. There were 12 men and 2 officers. There were thousands of octopi. On the face of it, their chances seemed hopeless. Not for a second did Keith count on getting many men to the NX-1, but he knew where the submarine was, and he had to try. Tersely, he gave them final instructions. "This corridor leads to the main entrance. That is, to the right, understand? Then straight down the street outside, to the left, is the square where they towed the NX-1. I'd say it was 100 yards. There's one guard outside. Graham, you and half the men to the right of the door. I'll take the rest to the left. Our only chance is to try and destroy the octopus's eyes." His mind cast about desperately for some form of weapon. The only detachable thing on their sea suits was the small helmet light, a thing, Keith told himself, without possible offensive use. Still, the beams would enable them to more clearly see their path and keep together, so he ordered them in hand. The men were grouped and alert. The moment had come. "Remember," he said, "its eyes. Then stick together and run like hell. All right, good luck, and let's go." Awkwardly, stumbling clumsily in the retarding water, the small group surged through the door. Immediately a black shape pounced upon them from the clustered shadows, the guarding octopus. Its tentacles seemed to be everywhere. In seconds 5 men were clutched in its awful grip, their fists rising and falling impotently as the hideous arms constricted and crushed them inward. Keith, free of the clasp, yelled, "The eyes! The eyes! Put out its eyes!" For answer, a yellow arm clutching a helmet light broke through the grotesquely milling mass and struck at the cuttlefish's great pools of eyes. It missed, but the switch flicked on, and there stabbed through the gloom a broad, glaringly white ray. Its effect was astounding. The beam smote the octopus squarely in its huge eyes, and immediately the creature shuddered, writhed with pain. The tentacles released the men, and the monster fled back into the protecting shadows. A shout from the men roared in the commander's earphones. "They can't stand the light," he cried. "Thank God! Beams on, everyone! Flash 'em in their eyes! Forward!" 14 shafts of eye-dazzling light forked through the corridor, the tiny company beating their path with criss-crossing shafts of white forged ahead. They thrashed the shadows with their beams, probing each inch of water, clearing their way even as a tank hoses machine-gun bullets before its clumsy body. Their former slender chance grew. They filled with hope. Another swarm of devilfish, long arms whipping before them, raced from branching corridors and bore down on the company of humans. The men were ready, and 14 tongues of white met them squarely. They faltered. The weight of their fellows behind shoved them on, but the rays steadied, and the front row of octopi broke in panic. The others at once followed in wild retreat. "Keep together, men," Keith ordered sharply. "One beam to each octopus, straight in its eyes till it retreats. Forward!" They pressed on. The octopi, with eyes used only to the soft blue glow of the cavern, could not stand against the brilliant rays. Keith, leading the NX-1's crew, stumbled out into the street. They faltered a moment when they saw each entrance hole of the mound buildings shooting out streams of octopi. Hundreds were in sight already. The whole city was evidently alarmed. Wells at once formed his men in a circle, so their beams would guard them on every side and above. Apparently the octopi could not approach within 30 feet of them, and even at that distance they turned and fled, writhing with pain whenever a shaft of light struck full in their eyes. "The square's just ahead," the commander roared. "One last rush now, and we'll reach the submarine. Stick close, keep your arms locked, and watch out above." The circle of men narrowed. The eyes gave their tiny cluster the appearance of a monster even more fantastic than those moiling around them, a monster with long straight tentacles of glaring white. They stumbled forward through the magically parting ranks of black octopi. The beams kept the creatures back. They were helpless before them. Foot by foot, under the inverted bowl of threshing tentacles, the NX-1's crew lumbered ahead. The street at last ceased. The wide square opened before them. "We're here!" Wells yelled exultantly. "This is the—" His voice fell into abrupt silence. He stared around the square, and his heart went cold indeed. They had reached the right place, but it was empty. The NX-1 was not there. End of Chapter 7. Section 10 of Astounding Stories 14, February 1931. By Various. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Tentacles from Below by Anthony Gilmore. Chapters 8 and 9. Chapter 8. Cook, the Navigator. Through all these hours, one man had remained on the NX-1, and that man was, to put it mildly, scared to death. Cook Angus McKegnie had been nearest the connecting ladder when Keith Wells roared out the command to retreat above, and his desire to regain a place of safety was so earnest that he made the control room in record time. At once he had felt the tingle of the paralyzing ray. Struck by a horrible thought, he ventured to peer down the ladder, and groaned to see the figures of his comrades all lying limply on the deck. His portly frame quivered like jelly as realization came to him that he was the only one who had escaped the ray. Heroic ideas of saving the submarine, of rescuing the men below, flashed wildly through his head, but only for a moment. On second thought, he felt he ought to hide. So in the tomb-like silence that had fallen, the 220-pound McKegnie wormed away behind an instrument panel, effecting the journey by vigorous shoves of his stomach. It was minutes later that he first noticed that some sharp jutting object was jutting deep into his ample paunch. But he could do nothing to remedy it. He was hidden anyway, and he was going to stay hidden. The cook felt the NX-1 being towed forward. Then, after a dreadful wait, he heard queer noises down below, and was positive the exit ports had opened. The snake-like slithering and shuffling which followed would mean that the enemy was inside the NX-1. The thought brought St. Vitus's dance to his limbs, and try as he might, he couldn't still them. Then again the ports opened, the gloomy silence returned, and Angus McKegnie was alone with his reflections. After the first hour he gave voice to them in one simple bitter sentence. "Just why the hell," he muttered, "did I ever join the Navy?" The silence offered no reply, and McKegnie, desperate from his cramped position, ventured to poke his head around the instrument panel. The faint emergency lights showed the control room to be empty. He decided to come out, and did so, worming his way back with great difficulty. Once out, the first thing his eyes fell on was the teleview screen. Now the cook had never seen one of the octopi. and the screen showed hundreds of monsters clustering around the NX-1. So with unusual promptness, he acted, jamming himself once again into his hiding place. Maybe, he thought, they had some way in which they could see into the control room and discover him. Hours passed. The cook was sopping with sweat. Finally, his thoughts emerged into words. "I got to get out of here," he said intensely. "I got to. And I got to run this submarine." The sound of his voice somehow emboldened him. Once more he backed out of his cranny, and with cautious, trembling steps explored the control room. He kept his eyes from the teleview, though it had a terrible fascination for him, and surveyed the NX-1's array of control instruments. The prospective navigator groaned at the sight. There were dozens of mysterious wheels jutting from every possible angle, squads of black and red-handled levers, whole armies of queer little stud buttons and dials. His knowledge of cooking helped him not at all in the presence of that maze of devices. Timidly he touched one of the levers, but immediately snatched his hand away as if afraid it would bite. His boldly announced purpose of running the craft went glimmering. An accidental glimpse of the monsters in the teleview suddenly decided him that he needed a weapon. He hunted frantically through the lockers and found three service revolvers, which he fastened at his waist, adding his own carving knife to the arsenal. But he didn't feel much better. Then, remembering for the first time his sea-suit radio, he yelled, "Mr. Wells! Mr. Wells! Oh, Mr. Wells, where are you? Can you hear me?" There was, of course, no answer. He tried to bring his muddled thoughts and fears to order. "I got to run this thing," he said doggedly. "Got to. Now, let's see. What the hell's this thing for? What the—" He broke off short, and his eyes went wide. He had heard a noise. Yes, there it was again, the same peculiar scraping at one of the exit ports. He glanced fearfully at the teleview. "Oh, Lord," he yelped, "they're coming in to get me." He started to dive back behind the instrument panel, but stopped, drew two guns, and in an agonized muddle trotted back and forth for a moment, waving them. Another look at the screen showed that an exit port was open, admitting two metal-scaled octopi. McKegnie couldn't stand it any longer. He wedged himself behind his panel again. Soon sounds of the metal tentacles on the deck below told him that one of the creatures was coming up the ramp. Then, slithering into the control room itself, the cook was a lather of cold perspiration. The octopus was apparently surveying this new part of the submarine. Then, without warning, the tip of a metal-scaled tentacle felt around the panel, and crept, exploring, up Angus McKegnie's leg, which leg was again suddenly afflicted with St. Vitus's dance. The tentacles coiled, pulled hard, and the cook, with a yowl, was yanked out into the room. Dangling upside down, high in the air, he submitted to the fishy stare of the great eyes under the sheathing of glass. But soon he started to squirm, and his violent contortions brought a rush of blood to his head, making him quite dizzy. It was while he was in that state that things started to happen. First, a great roar rolled through the NX-1, and McKegnie found himself flat on the floor with his breath knocked out. Then, while this was registering on his mind, he discovered himself the center of a madly milling set of tentacles, and instinctively scrambled out of the way. From a distance he saw that the tentacles belonged to the octopus that had held him, and that their coilings and threshings were gradually dying down, until only a quiver ran through them from time to time. While McKegnie was trying to figure this all out, he noticed that the monster's glass sheeting was shattered, that it lay in a pool of water, and that the odor of burnt powder was in the air. Looking down, he found that he had a gun in his hand. A thin wisp of smoke was curling from the barrel. "Gee whiz!" he ejaculated. "Gee whiz!" As he stood there recovering from his surprise, he heard the other octopus crawling up the connecting ramp, coming to see what had befallen its fellow. Preceded by two trembling guns, McKegnie tiptoed to the ramp and peered down. From the darkness he saw another complicated mass of metal tentacles and glass advancing up toward him. Fear smote the cook, and almost without volition he pointed his guns and pulled the triggers. As before, a bullet crashed into the great dome of glass, and he watched a short but terrible death struggle. He had, by himself, slain two octopi. A tremendous elation filled McKegnie, until it occurred to him that his shots might have been heard outside. At once he ran and looked at the teleview screen, and what he saw on its silver surface took all the triumph abruptly out of him. The octopi outside were darting about with alarming activity. A whole cluster of them was centered at the exit port, and even as the cook stared, the preliminary sounds of opening it came to his ears. "Now I got to run this ship," he groaned. He peered at the mass of levers and wheels, put out a hand, closed his eyes, hesitated, and pulled one of them back. Nothing happened. He tried another. The noise below grew, but still the NX-1 remained motionless. Desperate, the cook jerked several other levers. The whine of electric motors surged through the silence. The submarine shuddered and slewed off to the right, as if trying to dig into the sea floor. "I got it started," he cried. He did something else. The NX-1 stuck her bow dizzily up and sped into the misty blue realm above in a grand sweeping circle. The sea floor with its mound buildings and swarming octopi fell away behind with a rush. "There," muttered the triumphant cook. "But how did I do it?" The submarine was rising like a skyrocket. McKegnie remembered suddenly that Wells had said the cavern was only a few miles high. He must now be very near the top. He held his breath while he pushed a likely-looking lever the other way. He was lucky. The NX-1 capered like a two-year-old, kicked up her stern, and bolted eagerly for the depths once more. Again the floor of the cavern rushed up at him. Again he pulled the potent lever back, and again the submarine meteored upward. This procedure went on for some time. McKegnie was only running an elevator. Was he doomed to dash up and down between floor and ceiling forever? He gave forth pints of sweat, now and then groaning as the submarine grazed horribly close to the top or bottom. The dead octopus at his feet slithered limply around on the crazy angling deck. "I can't keep this up forever," the cook said peevishly. "Now, what the hell's this thing for?" He turned it, and the NX-1 tilted in one of her dives and raced forward, midway between ceiling and floor. Her navigator relaxed slightly. He had found the major controls. At least he had been able to stop his dizzy game of plunging up and down. Then, just as he was beginning to wonder where he could go, a large red spot glowed at the edge of the location chart. "Oh, Lord," he cried, "that's the other submarine, and it's coming after me." Evidently it was, for the red spot rapidly approached the green one. The paralyzing ray tingled, and a moment later the enemy's huge bulk loomed on the teleview screen, a band of violet light spearing from one of the jutting knobs. Frantically McKegnie juggled his levers, and then it was that the NX-1 really showed what was in her. She emulated, on a grand scale, a bucking bronco. She stood almost on her nose, and threatened to describe somersaults. She tried it the other way, on her stern. She rolled dizzily. She all but looped the loop and went staggering around the cavern in great erratic bounds that must have made the octopi think she was in the hands of a madman, which she practically was. Her designer would have had heart failure. In the teleview screen, the frantic McKegnie would see the octopi submarine rush erratically by with a flash of its violet heat ray. The location chart showed the red spot zigzagging drunkenly around the green one. Each boat made occasional short, crazy darts at the other. Sometimes they would stand approximately still. It was a riotous game of tag, and McKegnie knew too well that he was it. During one brief pause, the anguished cook found himself groaning aloud. "Oh, Mr. Wells, where are you? I can't keep this up. I can't. I can't." There were still several important-looking controls that were mysteries to him. But what if he should pull one and open all the exit ports? He shuddered at the thought. Things had become nightmarish. The ship was pitted scores of places by the heat ray. The control room had grown stifling. McKegnie was losing pounds of flesh, and literally stood in a pool of his own perspiration. The octopi craft kept doggedly after the NX-1, no matter how often and effectually the sweating cook's reckless hands prevented her getting the heat ray home. For a long time the two ships continued to race up and down. The NX-1 would plunge, pirouette around the other, and scamper away towards the ceiling as if enjoying it all hugely, abruptly to forsake her course and come zooming down once more. She would weave in romping circles and seem to go utterly crazy as her jumbled navigator pulled his levers and turned his wheels in a frantic effort to get somewhere. To get somewhere. Yes, But where? Oh, Mr. Wells, where are you? The harried cook would bleat at intervals. Or, plaintively, now, what the hell's this thing for? Chapter 9. At Bay. 14 humans stood at bay on the cold sea floor, dazed by the ruthless stroke of ill luck which had taken the NX-1 from where they had left it. "It's gone," whispered Graham over and over in a hopeless tone. Keith tried to pull himself together. He had to think of his men. In a second, his whole plan, which had seemed to be approaching success so rapidly, was smashed by the disappearance of the submarine. Mechanically, he kept his helmet light playing into the ever-thickening eyes and tentacles around him, while he scanned the seafloor nearby. It was filling more closely than ever with the black, writhing forms of the cuttlefish. The rays still held them back, but their great bulk loomed over the small party of humans like a sinister storm cloud. Soon, in their overwhelming mass, they would crush down, and the submarine's crew be conquered by sheer force of numbers. "Look," Keith cried, "there's where she was lying." He pointed out on the floor of the square a deep groove, obviously made by the hull of the NX-1. Its length and jaggedness seemed to denote that the submarine had tried to bore into the bed of the cavern itself. Wells was mystified. If the octopi ship had towed her away, she would certainly not have gouged that deep scar on the sea bottom. But he dismissed the strange disappearance from his mind. He had to work out a plan of action. "Keep together, men, and follow that scar," he ordered tersely. "There's a chance that the NX-1's somewhere further along." It was a futile hope, he knew. But there was nothing else. The tiny group, centered in the inverted bowl of black, writhing tentacles, lumbered onward. Then the octopi struck with another weapon, in an effort to dull the spearing beams of white. Here and there, from the mass of black, an even blacker cloud began to emerge. It quickly settled over the whole scene, pervading it with a pitchy, clinging darkness that obscured each man from his neighbor. "Ink!" cried one of them. It was sepia from the cuttlefish's ink sacs, the weapon with which these monsters of the underseas blind and confuse their victims. "Faster!" the commander roared in answer. "And for heaven's sake, keep together!" They huddled closer. Under the protecting cloud of ink, the mass of octopi pressed nearer. The struggle became fantastic, unreal, as the brilliant beams of white bored through the utter blackness, searching for eyes which the men knew were there, yet could not see until their rays chanced upon them. Snaky shadows milled horribly close to the little group of bulging yellow figures. Blacker and blacker grew the water. They could not always see the monsters as they drove them back on each side. Now and then a bold tentacle actually touched one of them for a moment, before its owner was thrust blinded away. Suddenly the dark cloud cleared a little as the fight moved into an unseen current. Their range of vision lengthened to 10 or 12 feet. They could dimly sense the looming mass of cuttlefish, and it was less often that one of the monsters darted forward, daring the rays of white, and became altogether visible. When this did happen, half a dozen dazzling beams converged on the octopus's eyes and drove it back in writhing agony. The men were the hub of a grotesque cartwheel, whose spokes were intercrossing rays of white. They still forged onward along the groove, but moved more slowly now, and Keith Wells, tired to death, realized the combat could not go on much longer. Their advance was useless, a mere jest. The NX-1 had vanished. It would only be a question of time before their batteries gave out, or the swarms of octopi crushed in on the struggling crew. Their overwhelming numbers would tell in the end. The men were silent, except for the occasional gasps which came from their laboring lungs. And then the king of the octopi appeared. Keith had been wondering, in the aching turmoil that was his brain, where the gold-banded monarch was. He knew the monster had been rescued, and he dreaded coming face to face once more with that huge form. Now armlets of glittering yellow suddenly flashed in the thick of the besieging tentacles, and two great evil eyes glared for a second at Keith Wells. The commander flung a burst of light at them and laughed crazily as the monster scurried back. For a few moments the king was not visible. "Well, fellows," Wells said, "it won't be long now. His Majesty's back on the field. He grinned a little through his weary face. "I wonder what he'll hatch up to combat our helmet lights. Watch close. He's damn clever." The commander did not have long to wonder. The vague wall of tentacles began retreating deeper into the ink. Keith could not imagine the reason for it, but held himself taut and ready. His men, likewise, noting the move, unconsciously grouped closer, waiting tensely for they knew not what. The king of the octopi had indeed hatched a plan of attack. After a moment the mass of creatures again became slowly visible, but this time, when the rays shot out, they did not hold them back. Could not, for their eyes were not visible. "My God!" Wells cried. "They're coming backwards!" It was so. The octopi, no doubt under their ruler's orders, had turned themselves around, and now, with eyes directly away from the dazzling shafts of white, were closing slowly in on the humans from all sides. The helmet lights were useless. They could not reach the creature's eyes. Tentacles coiling, whipping, interweaving, the wall of flesh pressed in. Death stared the helpless crew of the NX-1 in the face. First Officer Graham shrugged his shoulders and said tiredly, "Well, I guess it's all over. Unless," he added with a feeble smile, "somebody figures a way to melt us through the sea floor." Keith Wells's face suddenly lit up with an idea. He swung around and roared, "The hell, it's over! We can go up!" His crew understood at once. "What fools we—" Graham began, but Keith cut him short. "Listen," he rapped quickly, "jam together in one bunch and lock arms tight. When I give the word, flood your suits with air. We'll go up like comets, crash right through the devils. Hurry! All ready?" He saw that they were. "Then together. Go!" he commanded. As one man, the crew adjusted their air controls, bulging the sea suits with air. Their weighted feet left the cavern floor at once, and locked tightly together, the whole 14 of them shot like a bullet to the living ceiling of unsuspecting cuttlefish above. They hit with a terrific crash. Keith was momentarily stunned by the force of impact. He felt himself torn away from his men, felt a dozen tentacles snake over him, and mechanically stabbed out with his helmet light. For a moment he was held, then the air and his light pulled him through, and he broke out through the top. In his rocketing upward progress, the extra oxygen rapidly cleared his mind. Glancing below, he saw a great dark many-fingered cloud dropping rapidly away, and was glad to know that the octopi could not follow him into the lesser pressures above without their suits. Over the dark cloud he glimpsed a few scattered pinpoints of light, the helmet beams of the other men. They were rising as swiftly as he. "Thank God," he murmured reverently, "we broke through. We broke through." End of chapters 8 and 9. Section 11 of Astounding Stories 14, February 1931, by Various. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Tentacles from Below, by Anthony Gilmore. Chapters 10 and 11. Chapter 10, The Return of the Wanderer. Wells watched the several helmet lights shooting upwards and wondered if they represented all the men that had got safely through the net of tentacles. Remembering the rocky ceiling they were rapidly approaching, he ordered the others to reduce speed by discharging air from their sea suits. He received no articulate answer. Although he cut down the rush of his own progress, it was with a jar that he bounded to the top of the cavern. As he dangled there, he beheld four light beams hurtling upward. His earphones registered crash after crash, and then he saw the beams go spinning down into the gloom again, weaving and crossing fantastically, the shock having jerked them from their owner's hands. Keith had lost his own helmet light below, but peering around he could make out a few vague forms, bumping and twisting in the current. "Graham," the commander called. "Graham, you there?" After a moment his first officer's voice came thickly back. "Yes, here. A bit groggy. That crash..." Wells swam clumsily toward him. "I guess only a few of us broke through," the commander said slowly, as the two officers hung at the roof, swinging grotesquely. One by one, the other men came to their senses and reported their presence in the radiophone. Keith ordered them to cluster around him. and soon eight weird figures had grouped nearby. After a while they located two others, which brought their total to 10 men and 2 officers. They looked a long time, but could not find any more. 2 were gone. Deep silence fell over the tiny group. The dark mass of the rocky ceiling scraped their helmets. Below, the bluish waters tapered into a thick gloom, hiding, miles beneath, the mound buildings and swarming octopi. One of the men spoke. His words were audible to everyone, and they voiced the thought in every brain. "What are we going to do now?" Keith had no answer. They had escaped the immediate danger, but it was only a temporary respite. The commander knew it was hopeless to try and locate the tunnel leading to the outer sea, for they were very tired, and in their clumsy suits they would be able to swim only a few rods. Their helmet lights were gone. They had played their last card. "They're going to find us after a while," the pessimistic voice continued. "They'll send that submarine of theirs after us, or maybe they'll come up in their metal suits." "Well," Keith replied with forced cheerfulness, "then we'll have to fight 'em off." "Why not rip our suits and end it now?" began another, but Graham's voice cut in sharply. "Quiet," he said. "I heard something." The men stilled abruptly. In tense silence, their ears strained at the headphones. Wells asked, "What did you hear?" "Wait," Graham interrupted, listening intently. "There it is again. Listen. Can't you hear it? Why, it sounded like... Keith concentrated his whole mind on listening, but could catch nothing at all. He was just about to give up when he caught a faint, jumbled murmur, the murmur of a human voice. "My God!" he whispered. The voice, little by little, grew, and Wells could distinguish words. They formed into a complete sentence. Keith heard it plainly. It was... "Now what the hell's this thing for?" Unmistakably, it was the voice of Cook Angus McKegnie, whom they all had thought dead. Amazed, the men of the crew started to jabber. "Quiet," Wells ordered sharply. He listened again. McKegnie's voice was growing quickly and steadily louder. "McKegnie," the commander cried excitedly. "McKegnie, can you hear me?" There was no answer. Patiently, Wells waited a minute, every second of which increased the volume of his long-lost cook's bewildered tones. Again he tried. "McKegnie, can you hear me? This is Commander Wells. McKegnie." The cook's stammering voice came back. Why, is that you, Mr. Wells? Did I hear you, Mr. Wells?" "Yes," Keith shouted impatiently. "This is Commander Wells. For heaven's sake, McKegnie, where are you?" "I don't know, sir," the cook responded. "Where are you?" Keith was for the moment perplexed. But are you a prisoner?" he questioned, and he could have sworn he heard a distinct note of pride as the invisible McKegnie replied, "Oh, no, sir, not yet. These devils been trying their best to get me, but they couldn't. No, sir." Wells became more and more puzzled. But you're not running the Annex 1, are you?" McKegnie's voice was much louder now and growing every second. The note of pride persisted. "Of course, sir," he confirmed. "It was kind of hard at first with these octopuses bothering me, but I got onto it pretty quick. That octopus ship chased me with them heat rays for a long time, but I ain't seen them lately. I guess I kind of tired them out." His last words grew louder with a rush, and from the dark depths beneath a long shape suddenly appeared, hurtling up at the group of astounded men in a zoom that bade fair to take it straight through the ceiling. It was the Annex 1. "Dive, man, dive!" Keith yelled. "Cook, pull that black-handled lever towards you. Yank it back, yank it back, quick!" He sighed with relief as he saw his madly driven submarine pause, whip its nose downward, and crash back for the depths from which it had come. The commander spoke rapidly. "McKegnie, listen. Leave the black lever halfway so you'll level out. Straighten your helm. We're only a little above you. Come around in a circle till I tell you to stop." The NX-1 came out of her dive, and as the cook evidently shoved her helm over, went skirting around in a wide, drunken circle, some 1,000 feet below her regular crew. "All right," Keith shouted. The fear that the octopi submarine would dart back before he could get aboard his ship was looming in his mind. "You're at the helm, cook. There's a wheel right over your head. Spin it around. Oh, my God, there you go again," he groaned, while the NX-1 went swooping off on a repetition of her crazy circle. "Sorry, sir," the culinary navigator said thickly. "I guess I got the wrong thing." "Now," Wells roared, "spin that wheel above your head." "That's right. Right. There. Don't touch a thing, Cook. We're coming down." The submarine had paused directly beneath them, listing slightly to port. Then began the cautious business of the descent. Under Wells's rapid orders, the men linked arms again and discharged more air from their sea suits. Slowly, thin chains of bubbles rising behind them, they sank towards the dim shape of the NX-1 below. Wells's eyes kept probing the thick gloom far beneath. Every moment he expected to see it disgorge a swarm of octopi. They neared the submarine and saw numberless pitted spots in her body where the heat ray had stabbed for a moment. In their excitement, they missed their level by some feet, but clutching together, they admitted more air and soon rose even with the starboard exit port. "Swim forward," Keith ordered. "Hurry." The weird figures groped clumsily and very slowly neared the port. The commander, in the van, at last, reached out and gripped its jutting external controls. He could not work them at first. His hands were numb and awkward. As he tugged and struggled with them, a shout rang in his headphone. It was McKegnie, scared to death. "Oh, hurry, Mr. Wells," he yelled. "Quick, quick, please. The octopus ship's coming, sir. The red light's back." Chapter 11. To the Death. He got the door open and motioned Graham and six men inside the water chamber. The passage took but a minute. Then he sent the rest of the crew in, being himself the last to enter. When the chamber was finally empty, and Wells had stepped through the inner door onto the lower deck of the NX-1, a great sigh of relief broke from him. Never before had anything looked so good as that brilliantly lit deck with its familiar maze of machinery and bulkheads. "Thank God," he said simply, and his joy was shared by the whole crew. A new feeling had come over them. Back home, in their own submarine, their own element, they had at least a fighting chance with the octopi. But Keith let them waste no time. He knew that a final desperate duel to the death with their foe still was ahead. "Above to the control room," he ordered. "Fast!" They lumbered up the connecting ramp. A disheveled, wild-eyed form met them. Keith couldn't help chuckling as he passed the now much thinner and paler Cook with the arsenal handy at his waist. On the deck of the control room lay a huge tentacled body, metal-scaled, with its dome of glass shattered and its great cold eyes staring unseeingly away. "I killed him," stammered McKegnie pridefully. "But Mr. Wells, look at that red light, sir." Keith glanced rapidly at the location chart, ripping off his sea suit as he did. The fateful red stud was moving swiftly down on the motionless green one. The men had surrounded McKegnie, laughing and slapping him on the back, but the commander's terse orders jerked them abruptly back to action. "The rectifiers, Graham. Clean out this stale air. Sea suits off. At emergency posts. Take the helm, Craig. You, Weatherby, trim the ship. No, no, Cook. Keep away from the controls." The NX-1 balanced herself. Fresh air came rushing in, sweeping out the stale. Keith stared at the location chart, waiting for the submarine to be ready. The red light was almost upon them. "Right," he roared at last. "Diving rudder controls, Graham. Full speed for the tunnel." At that moment the octopi ship swept into view, its full battery of offensive weapons flaring forth. The paralyzing ray tingled again and again over the control room. Someone laughed at its uselessness. The violet heat ray leveled full at them, but the commander avoided it with "Port 10, starboard 10. Maintain zigzag course to the tunnel." He understood the enemy's weapons now. He was throbbing with the fierce thrill of action. This duel was to be the climax of their whole adventure. And by heaven, he promised, it's going to be a fight. The other craft seemed to realize the NX-1 was now in expert hands. She raced along to starboard for some minutes, her heat ray trying vainly to steady on the American's weaving form. Wells wondered if the king of the octopi was aboard her, in command. He thought perhaps the ship had postponed her chase of McKegnie to pick him up. "I hope he is," the commander breathed, and fingered the torpedo lever. He had some debts to pay. The NX-1, engines working smoothly, proceeded on a desperate dash for the tunnel that led to the outer sea. But the octopi ship apparently knew what Keith intended, for she abandoned her offensive rays, changed course a few degrees, and slowly but steadily pulled ahead. "Damn," Keith exclaimed, "she'll get there before us." The dim shape dwindled on the screen, and before long her bulk had disappeared entirely. Wells then could watch her swift, straight progress only on the location chart. 10 minutes later, the funnel-like opening of the tunnel loomed on the teleview, and squarely in front, blocking it, was the waiting form of the octopi submarine. "Quarter speed," Keith snapped. "Hold her steady, Graham. I'm going to try a bow torpedo. I think we're beyond their ray." Sighting his range on the telescopic rangefinder, he worked the NX-1 slowly into position. He noticed that his first officer was staring oddly at him. He was bothered by the queer look. "What's wrong?" he asked impatiently. "But what about Hemi Bowman?" Bowman. In the rush of action and suspense, Keith Wells had completely forgotten his officer in the enemy submarine. "Oh, God," he groaned. The cruel situation that had stayed his hand once before had again come to falter his course of action. The men were watching him. Graham had a question in his eyes. They all knew what had to be decided. Keith shrugged his shoulders hopelessly. It was his greater duty to destroy the octopi submarine. And yet... "Fish for Hemi, Sparks," he ordered. "Craig, keep present distance from enemy. Full stop." A moment later, the radio operator looked up. "Mr. Bowman on the phone, sir." With a heavy weight on his heart, the commander clipped on the extension headphones. "Hemi? Keith? Keith? Thank God you're alive." Bowman's voice shook with gladness. "You're all back on the NX-1, Keith? The whole crew's with you? Oh, Lord, it's good to hear you again." "Yes, we got back all right, Hemi. A miracle." "They've still got you prisoner?" "Yes." "Keith, you're trying to dodge out of the tunnel, aren't you?" Wells smiled bitterly, and as he paused to frame an answer, Bowman spoke again. "I want you to blow up this submarine, Keith," he said quickly. "A favor to me." He cut Wells short when the commander started to interrupt. "Wait, let me finish," he pleaded. "I want to explain. I'd been hoping, but never mind that, Keith. A while ago I managed to work loose. I lost my head completely and tackled these devils. It was a foolish thing to do. They overcame me, naturally. But in the struggle, they tore my sea suit."
"What?"
"Oh, just a tiny tear, or I wouldn't have lasted till now. But a leak all the same, in the right leg. Since then I've been gripping the edges of the fabric as tightly as I can, but I couldn't keep the water inside the ship from seeping through. It came in slowly at first, then faster as my hands grew numb. It's up to my neck now, Keith, and it won't be long. I've just a few minutes left." The faint words tapered into silence. "No," roared Keith in a great rush of emotion. But Hemi's eager voice came right back. "Oh, yes, you must. It would be a mercy to kill me, Keith." There were tears in the commander's eyes. "Are you sure, Hemi?" he asked. "Are you sure?" "Oh, yes, it would be a mercy." Wells's lips formed a straight, grim line. His words squeezed through it tightly. "All right, Hemi. Thanks. Thanks. I'll go after them now, old man. I'll try and keep in touch with you through the duel. But I can't promise..." He could almost see Hemingway Bowman give his old familiar smile as he answered, "Then so long, Keith." Commander Keith Wells studied the teleview screen. The men were half afraid to look at his strained, blanched face. Repeatedly, the violet beam speared through the water, reaching for the NX-1's bow. "Turn ship. Line up for stern torpedoes," the commander ordered, harshly. He realized he could not hold his submarine steady to obtain a perfect sight, for the heat ray needed only 30 seconds to melt through their shell. He would have to swing the ship slowly about, and, as the shape of the enemy crossed the hairlines on the rangefinder, unleash his torpedoes and gamble on hitting the moving target. The NX-1 swung around, always maintaining a slight forward motion and zigzagging constantly to nullify the heat beam. Wells watched the rangefinder closely. The octopi ship slanted downwards, the deadly violet ray stabbing from her bow. Slowly the black dot that represented her appeared on the dial, and slowly it dropped towards the crossed lines that showed the perfect firing point. Keith grasped the torpedo lever. The NX-1's stern was towards her target. Dead silence hung in the control room. The NX-1 swung slightly. The octopi craft appeared directly in the middle of the dial. Wells pulled back the lever. The hiss of compressed air sprang from her stern. He had fired two tubes, his whole stock of stern torpedoes. The pair of dreadful weapons leaped out and settled on their course. Keith shot his gaze to the teleview. The torpedoes missed. Only by feet, but a miss all the same. They raced on past the Occupy submarine, and with a tremendous, ear-numbing explosion burst on the wall of the cavern beyond. Both ships reeled from the shock. Graham swore viciously, but Wells's mask-like face showed no slightest change of expression. A voice rang in Keith's headphones. "Tough, Keith. Better luck next time." Then the commander winced. He simply could not answer Hemi Bowman, could not answer that fine, brave voice. The stern torpedoes were gone. The tubes could not be reloaded, for the paralyzing ray bound the men to the control room. That left them two torpedoes in the bow. The violet heat ray kept fingering hungrily on their outer hull, and every man knew that the plates were weakening under the steady strain, which was only lessened by the NX-1's constant zigzagging. The control room was very hot. Both ships were now a full mile from the tunnel entrance. Keith plunged the NX-1 down, swung her around to bring his bow tubes to bear, and zigzagged upwards. It was obvious that the octopi craft had been alarmed by the terrific explosion. They now adopted tactics similar to the American ships, and for a while both submarines circled cautiously, maneuvering for an opening. "If only we could keep the ship steady," Graham muttered. "But then that heat ray'd get us." The commander kept his eyes on the teleview. Again and again the violet shaft pronged at them. The heat grew stifling. Sweat was pouring from all the men's bodies. Every face was strained and taut. "Starboard full," Wells said suddenly. "A little up, Graham." He had seen a chance. The octopi craft was slightly above, and in a moment would pass directly in the line of the bow tubes. The NX-1 stuck her nose up, swung rapidly to the right. Keith pulled back the firing lever, releasing one torpedo. The long messenger of death hurtled straight for the enemy's hull. They watched its course breathlessly. "My God," the first officer groaned. "Could they see it coming?" For the octopi submarine had swung to one side, neatly dodging the speeding tube of dynamite. "One left," he added bitterly. "One left." A desperate plan formed in Keith Wells's mind. His last torpedo simply had to strike the mark. He could take no chances with it. He motioned the haggard-faced Graham to him. "There's only one thing left to do," he said quietly. "We've got to deliberately face that heat ray. Chance it's puncturing our plates." "How do you mean, sir?" "Get in very close so as to make our last torpedo sure to hit. We've got to approach the enemy head-on at full speed. We'll corkscrew up to them until we get within 200 yards, then go straight forward for 10 or 15 seconds, giving us the opportunity to sight the remaining torpedo directly on them. The heat ray may break through before I fire, but when I do fire, it's a sure hit." The men had heard every word. Quietly, Wells ordered, "Take the torpedo control, Graham. I'll take the helm." The first officer obeyed without a word. Keith grasped the helm. The plans were made for their last desperate attempt. "Right," the commander said shortly. "Here we go." There had been a taut silence before, but now, knowing that they were deliberately offering themselves a perfect target for the heat ray in order to get their last torpedo home, the intensity was almost unbearable. The men felt like shrieking, jumping, doing anything to break the awful hush. The air was charged with the same unnameable something that heralds a typhoon. Keith Wells was like a white statue at the helm, save for the betraying trickles of sweat that coursed down his drawn cheeks. His hands moved the wheel slowly from port to starboard, his eyes bored at the screen before him. The ship was in command of a man of steel, a man with but one purpose. "Up, up," he ordered. "Hold, in trim, full speed forward." He had brought the NX-1 directly in line with the octopi ship, and now the craft leaped forward under full power, while he shot the helm back and forth ceaselessly. His ship was describing a corkscrewing motion, weaving straight at the enemy, grasping her opportunity The octopi submarine remained motionless, steadily dousing the approaching American craft with her silent violet ray and driving the temperature in the control room to even greater heights. The distance between them rapidly lessened. Would the plates stand it? Would the ray melt through the weakened steel before he could fire? With an effort, Keith drove these doubts from his mind, but he could not banish a certain dull, steady ache from his consciousness. The range dwindled. The heat became intolerable. Everyone's clothing was sopping wet. A man ripped off his shirt, gasping for air. Wells kept his eyes on the screen, though half blinded by smarting sweat. The plates had to give soon, he knew. The octopi submarine, beam on and dead ahead, began to move to port at quickly increasing speed. At once Keith stopped swinging the helm, and the NX-1's corkscrewing motion of protection ceased. And then came the real test, the gauntlet of seconds. Right straight into the retreating violet beam they went, at top speed. They gained rapidly. The heat was furnace-like. The commander, watching the rangefinder, kept moving the helm slightly over. A shaft of violet heat spanned the two shells of metal. For 10 seconds it had held on the NX-1. The black dot of the enemy craft moved slowly to exact center on the dial. 15 seconds. 20. 23. Fire! Graham jammed the torpedo lever back. Crash dive! The deck tilted downward, and Wells's white lips formed the words, "So long, Hemi," and he tore the phones from his head. Seconds later, a titanic explosion sounded through the cavern, echoed and re-echoed in vasty roars. The American craft's lights went off, but not before her men had seen, in the teleview, a fire-shot maelstrom where a moment before the octopi submarine had been. "We got them!" yelled Graham. A roar of exultation burst from every throat. The men flung their arms out, jumped, yelled crazily. Faint emergency lights lit the scene. "Below, at regular posts," Wells ordered. "Reload bow and stern tubes. Graham, see to the lights." He himself remained at the helm. In a few moments, the submarine had climbed back to the level of the tunnel. At quarter speed, she nosed into the wide entrance and slowly forged into the dense, deceptive shadows. The commander acted mechanically. Again, by touch, he steered his ship through the black, ragged cleft. 15 minutes after leaving the cavern of the octopi, her bow poked through the weaving kelp into the free, salty depths of the Atlantic Ocean. There was one more task to perform, and Wells lost no time in doing it. When 200 yards away, he halted the NX-1, steadied her, and sighted the stern tubes just above the dark tunnel hole. Quickly he sent forth 2 torpedoes. A huge roar rumbled through the water, whipping the beds of kelp to mad convulsions. "Turn around," the commander ordered harshly. He sighted his bow tubes and again let loose a bolt of 2 torpedoes. Then he sent the submarine forward, and through the teleview examined what his 4 weapons had done. Huge chunks of rock had been tumbled down, completely closing the tunnel. "Well," said Graham, "it's over. Finished. They'll never get through that." A full-throated cheer burst from the men below, a cheer that rang for minutes as they realized they were free forever of the octopi, of the cold underwater city, of the clutching tentacles. Graham grinned broadly. "Sound happy, eh?" he chuckled. "Say, Keith, it's good we've got those 2 octopi our fighting cook killed. Knapp would never believe our story without them." He stared curiously at his commander. Wells was standing quite still, facing the teleview screen. A strange, faraway look was in his eyes. "What's the matter, old man?" the first officer asked, smiling straight at him. "Aren't you glad we won through?" "Of course," answered Keith, with a tired smile in return. "But why did you look that way?" Graham persisted, and Keith Wells told him. "I was just wondering if Hemi told the truth." End of chapters 10 and 11. And end of The Tentacles from Below by Anthony Gilmore.